I'm afraid this bar is closed.
What are you doing?
This is silly.
Man. Why?
Because it's against the law.
In a world where alcohol is illegal.
Put the whiskey down, motherfucker!
No. One amendment dared to take away a public vice.
She's adding?
No.
Bootlegging.
On January 16th, 1920, mankind faces its most oppressive legislation.
What gives you the right to take away my gin?
Bolston. That's who.
The 18th Amendment, coming soon to a constitution near you.
Okay, so I'm here with Daniel Ockrent, who is most recently the author of Last Call, The Rise and Fall of Prohibition. Daniel, how are you doing?
I'm very well. How are you today?
Doing fantastic. I wanted to, first of all, start with the Anti-Saloon League. Politics, as we all know, makes strange bedfellows, and here there was rather fey carnality. You had the Anti-Saloon League, you had the Ku Klux Klan as an ASL supporter, and then, of course, you point out the Wobblies distributed leaflets believing liquor to be an enemy of the working class. And in 1914, 17 of the 18 Progressive Party supporters, the members, voted dry. So I'm curious, though, why the Wobblies and the Progressive Party aligned themselves with the Klan, because after all, the Klan was an extremely racist...
It was the strangest of bedfellows.
Yeah,
they gathered around an issue, or not around any other affinity. The issue was something that was kind of a stand-in issue for a lot of other issues for some organizations, but that meant that it was accommodating to people from all different stripes. So I say, you know, there's this amazing partnership of the Ku Klux Klan, portions of the Socialist Party, the Progressive Party, Jane Addams and the Settlement House movement, this big movement for prohibition, the suffrage movement, they were essential to it, all for their own reasons. So that the KKK, it was largely, in their part, an anti-immigrant movement. They hated the Catholics and the Jews in the cities, the Catholics particularly, because of their political power, the growing political power of the political machines, largely Irish in the big cities of the East, and changing the complexion of Congress. And they saw prohibition as a tool to use against them. The other end of the spectrum, the IWW and portions of the Socialist Party, they opposed liquor because they thought it was the capitalists' way of keeping the working man down.
Yeah.
Actually, interestingly, you know, there was prohibition in the Soviet Union even. It existed first in Russia under the Tsar, amazingly. That had more to do with saving grain for the war effort during World War I. But the various remnants of prohibition didn't disappear entirely until after Lenin was dead. And there was a belief among some people close to Lenin that the Russian Revolution could not have happened had not the proletariat gotten its head cleared from its addiction to vodka. So all sorts of different reasons bring together this really unlikely coalition.
But in your research, did you encounter any reticence on the part of the Klan or the Wobblies or the Progressive Party?
They all functioned separately. The Anti-Saloon League was a good clearinghouse. The Anti-Saloon League was made up almost entirely of Methodists and Baptists from the middle of the country, white Methodists and Baptists. But what they really were political geniuses, particularly Wayne B. Wheeler. Yeah. Wayne Wheeler was called, at the time of his death in 1927, the Washington Post called him, they said that when the history of our time is being written, the first name that will be mentioned is that of Wayne B. Wheeler. And of course, no one today has heard of Wayne B. Wheeler, but he was the combination of Karl Rove and David Plouffe and James Carville and Lee Atwater, who engineered this vast coalition, even though the various members of the coalition didn't have anything to do with each other.
Well, the question is what made this guy so determined? I mean, 2 weeks before his death, he still attended the World Congress Against Alcoholism meeting in Indiana, even after his wife and his father-in-law had died out of a gasoline fire. He still carried on despite his ill health, despite being clobbered by Clarence Darrow at Carnegie Hall. What was the specific thing that kept him going? Was it a desire for a greater victory or another victory or lust for power? Or?
I think he really believed in prohibition. I'm not saying that those other things weren't also true, and I'll get to that in a moment, but I think this was a cause that he truly believed was essential for the Republic. He also did not shy away from the accumulation of power that came with his winning this, that having put an amendment to the Constitution, no pressure group has ever been able to do that before or since, that a popular movement created an amendment to the Constitution was an astonishment. And I think that once he had accomplished that, Wheeler realized that he was a man of vast power and influence. He also was the leading dispenser of patronage because he could not get a job in the Prohibition Bureau enforcing it without Wayne Wheeler's approval. So he had every reason to hold on to his position, both out of his out of conviction and also out of comfort with the power that he had accumulated.
Did he not even read his own press?
He did read his own press, and he had an interesting manner. On the one hand, as a political infighter, he was vicious, but he was ethical, and he was also cordial. And in fact, at his debates with Clarence Darrow and others, he couldn't have been nicer. He was always polite to the people who criticized him. Now, when the people who criticized him weren't around, he had some rather nasty things to say about him. But the guy was the real thing. He was an extraordinarily adept political organizer and strategist, and he did believe in his cause. Yeah.
I wanted to ask you about Walgreens. You point out that it went from 20 locations in 1920 to 525 during the 1920s, pointing out that it wasn't just milkshakes that was responsible for this expansion. Yet all you present in the book to support this possibility is an interview with Charles Walgreen Jr., who said in an interview with John Bacon that his father didn't want the fire department in the stores because he was losing cases of liquor. I'm wondering if you made any efforts to corroborate this claim from another source. Has Walgreens managed to hush this up?
Well, I think be careful. I don't make a claim.
Yeah.
You know, I say that...
Suggestion, then.
I make a suggestion, and that's all I can do is make a suggestion. But we do know this to be true. We know from Charles Walgreen Sr.'s testimony to his son that they had liquor in the stores, and he was afraid of losing it to thieves, right? Number two, we know that he had 20 stores at the beginning of Prohibition and 525 at the end. And if you want to believe it's milkshakes, believe that it's milkshakes. But in fact, the medicinal liquor business was an enormous business, not just for the Walgreen drug stores, but for pharmacists across the country. You know, I have a bottle at home on my shelf. It's kind of an inspiration. It's an empty bottle. It says Jim Beam, bottled and bond for medicinal purposes only. This was a pure racket. And druggists, unless they had some kind of scruple that few apparently had, made a fortune because of it.
But beyond the Bacon interview, did you make any efforts to try?
Yeah, I made efforts, and there's nobody alive in the Walgreen family today that I tried to make contact with that had any thought about it either way or not. I don't think that there's been a conscious effort to cover it up. I think that it's just forgotten.
Al Capone cultivated an image of benevolence, and you also point to Seattle bootlegger Roy Olmsted, who was quite ethical by comparison. He didn't dilute his liquor. He didn't resort to mob tactics. I'm wondering what factors made Olmsted a more ethical bootlegger. Was it Olmsted the man, or was it the makeup of Seattle in comparison to the competitive, violent world of Chicago?
Yeah, I think that the latter has a lot to do with it. By all evidence, Olmsted was a decent man. You know, he was the youngest police lieutenant in the history of the Seattle Department. He was, you know, looked on as a golden boy of sorts. But because of his honesty, because he didn't dilute, because he didn't raise prices, he had very happy customers in Seattle. And he also worked very well with anybody else who was in the business. He built a big coalition, really kind of a market-controlling coalition he controlled all of the booze that was coming into the Pacific Northwest. Capone was in a very different circumstance. I think that he was a different type of man to begin with. And secondarily, he was in an extremely competitive, cutthroat, murderous environment in which other people were trying to get a piece of the action. Olmsted didn't try to accrue power to himself. He liked to run a good business. Capone wanted to be in charge. The thing that, to me, about Capone that's most surprising relative to the popular image we have of Capone is that, you know, when he took over Chicago, he was 25 years old. He was a kid, and he was gone before he was 30.
And he was played by all these older actors,
yeah,
too.
Yeah, you know, I ask people, how old do you think Al Capone was when he ran Chicago? They say 48, 37, 50. But he was a baby.
But in Seattle, was there violence involved?
There wasn't much violence in Seattle. There was a nicely cooperative operation between the those who enforced the law and those who were breaking the law, including the fact that the justices of the peace who presided over hearings and trials, they got a piece of the fine. So they liked the idea of people being arrested, paying a fine, and then let them out again so they can be arrested again so they can pay the fine again.
So Olmsted set the precedent of a peaceful, money-oriented coalition here.
Yeah, I think that there were others like that elsewhere in the country, but Seattle was remarkably free of the violent crime that hit the eastern and midwestern cities.
What other cities were nonviolent in terms of bootlegging?
Nonviolent. San Francisco.
Yeah.
I think that San Francisco and to some degree New Orleans are the ones that come immediately to mind. San Francisco never really acknowledged that Prohibition existed. Even the judges in San Francisco, they threw cases out. The DA of San Francisco, you know, which is both a city and a county, he was an official in the organization against the Prohibition Amendment. He campaigned against it. So violence wasn't necessary because there was nobody trying to corner a market. It was an open market for everybody.
I also wanted to ask about the speakeasies. You point out that, of course, bars before were very male-dominated, and they became mixed with the advent of the speakeasy. Was it merely the table service? Was it possibly the rise in women's suffrage and women's rights that led to this greater integration?
Well, I wouldn't say it's women's suffrage, because women's suffrage movement was so critical to the passage of the Prohibition Amendment. They were too closely tied. My supposition, and it's only a supposition, is that once the saloon is outlawed and becomes an outlaw place, it acquires a certain exotic quality. And women who are coming into their own in terms of the culture of the time say, well, let's, you know, the term let's go slumming actually is a Prohibition term as well. Let's see what that's like. So that the traditions that dominated the saloon were thrown out with the legal status of the saloon. So women come in, and then, because women are coming, then you have table service, because you're not going to have women belling up to the bar in 1923. That wouldn't have been very nice. And once you have women and men dining together, you have to have music. That hadn't existed. I mean, the nightclub did not exist in this country until Prohibition. And outlaw music, jazz, comes into these outlaw places. They have to build facilities, toilet facilities for the women. That's the advent of the powder room. You know, it was a tiny room that, you know, the saloon didn't have a women's room. There were no women in the saloon. So they had to find corners of the saloon, you know, behind the bar, underneath the stairway, a broom closet, convert that to a one-toilet room for a room with a toilet and a sink for a woman to use, and that's called the powder room. So all sorts of changes in our social interaction, the way that we drink or don't drink together, that were compelled by Prohibition.
So just as the ASL had a coalition on a single issue, so too did the speakeasies, you would say.
I suppose so. I would suppose so. You know, the people, all sorts of people wanted different things out of their speakeasies, but what they really wanted to do was to be able to have their drink in public and uninterrupted. You know, it's important to remember that it was not against the law to drink. It was against the law to transport or manufacture or sell alcoholic beverages. But that was actually one of the things that Wayne Wheeler put into the legislation, the enforcement legislation, because he knew that if it was against the law to drink, then you would never get drinkers to be able to testify against their suppliers, and that's what he wanted more. So people could go into a speakeasy, they could go into a nightclub, they could drink without any fear of being arrested. In New York, the first arrest of people for drinking, for possession, were in 1930, 10 years into Prohibition.
Yeah.
It was the people who were selling it that were at some legal risk.
I wanted to talk about the 1928 election, which you bring up in the book. You point out New York's Mullin-Gage Act, which was referred to as Little Volstead, was repealed by Al Smith when he was governor. You note that Reverend Bob Jones called him the worst-hated man in America, but he was also well-loved by the wet Democrats. I'm wondering to what degree Mullin-Gage was responsible for his downfall during the 1928 presidential election. You indicate that a Klan rag called Fellowship Forum connected Smith's Catholicism with Prohibition, but this was published in early October, so we're talking about a month here before the actual election. I'm wondering how, to what degree these sentiments were compartmentalized, the Prohibition sentiment and the anti-Catholic sentiment.
I think that the anti-Smith factions in both the Republican and the Democratic Party used Prohibition as a smokescreen, because that was an acceptable thing for them to be supporting and to criticize Smith because he was wet. What they really didn't want was a Catholic. There was violent and virulent anti-Catholicism that motivated the anti-Smith movement. Yeah, sure, there were some people who opposed him because he was a prohibitionist, but had he been a wet Catholic, they would have opposed him as well, because they, you know, the term rum Romanism and rebellion, left over from the 1880s, was invoked again and again and again. I have a cartoon in the book from a magazine of the time that shows, you know, if Al were president and there's Smith at the head of the table and he's surrounded by men wearing exclusively ecclesiastic garb, they're all cardinals and such. Smith's Catholicism was the flashpoint, I believe, not the Prohibition.
Yeah, but to what degree were they merged? Because you're having this month window where there was a connection, as you point out in the book. Bingo.
Yeah, I mean, obviously they were merged. I mean, but what we have to remember about the 1928 election is the very fact of Smith being a wet brought the discussion of whether Prohibition was a good or bad thing into the public debate, really for the first time since its enactment. It had bubbled up somewhat in some hearings in 1926, but in 1928, Prohibition itself becomes an issue, and Smith doesn't run away from that issue, and his enemies, either motivated by their anti-Catholicism or by the Prohibition movement, they're happy to use that month very effectively.
Hoover claimed in his memoirs that it was Al Smith who brought up the Prohibition issue. Would you say that that's fairly accurate?
Yeah, I think it absolutely is. In the 1920 and 1924 elections, none of the four major party candidates addressed Prohibition. And even in the Democratic platform in 1928, you know, we believe in law enforcement was the way of dealing with it. But Smith, by the very fact of his existence, brought the issue up. Having led the repeal of the state prohibition law in New York, which of course didn't affect whether it was legal or not to sell liquor, but it meant that the New York State Police weren't enforcing it any longer. The very fact of that, plus his roots in the saloon-based, clubhouse-based Tammany Hall politics of New York City, made it an issue. Hoover is absolutely right. Mm-hmm.
You know that the luxury cruise business as we know it today has its roots in the so-called cruise to nowhere, the booze cruise. But what of the cruise lines that existed before, most famously the Titanic or the Princess in Victoria Louise or the Hamburg America line? I'm wondering what made the booze cruises influence any different from the ones that came before Prohibition?
Well, those that existed before went from one place to another. You know, you went from New York to Southampton, or you went to, from New York to Le Havre. The transatlantic ships were means of transportation to get from place to another. The booze cruises that became popular in the 20s of leaving New York, Baltimore, and other East Coast ports to go simply float around outside the 3-mile limit, later the 12-mile limit, and allowing people to drink, or going to the Caribbean, which had no cruise business before that, that was all driven by Prohibition and people's wish to be able to drink legally somewhere.
Yeah. Vino Sano Grape Brick, a form of grape juice concentrate that was sold in sherry, champagne, port, muscatel flavors, told the customer not to let it sit so long because it might ferment and become wine. It was one of the most brazen products on the market, along with Vine Glow, which you bring up, which was marketed by Fruit Industries Limited, a consortium of five of the leading wineries. I'm curious, because both of these came after around 1929, what took the wineries so long to just flout in the face of this, of the law, like the Volstead Clause?
I think what it was this enormous boom in the value of selling raw grapes for shipment to the East. Beginning in 1920, the value of wine grapes suddenly skyrockets. Grapes that had sold for as little as $10 a ton before 1920 sold during some spikes as high as $375 a ton. It was legal for people to make their own wine for their own personal use in their own homes. So you had thousands of freight cars leaving California during the grape harvest every year. And the grape growers did very, very well by it. But they overproduced, they overgrew, and the prices plummeted around 1926, 1927. That would explain the late arrival of Vine Glow and Vinsano. The other thing that they did is that they were following late, I'll acknowledge, what the brewers were doing. The brewers who stayed in business started marketing malt syrup somewhat easier so that you could make beer at home. Perfectly legal to sell the grape or to sell the wine brick or to sell the malt syrup. Those were not alcoholic beverages. It's what you, the consumer, did with them that made them intoxicating and thus would have been illegal had they been sold that way.
Well, aside from the floundering grape crop, I wonder if this is just a natural expansion of the market, to what degree that was.
Oh, sure. There's no question about that. And in fact, there was an effort conflate the market that they were going after in Chicago, and particularly with the market that was controlled by Capone and his mob in Chicago. They were rivals. That when the fruit industries, which, you know, legitimate businessmen presumably, came in with their grape brick, that was a challenge to those who were selling illegal liquor.
The original definition of temperance didn't mean... it wasn't so absolute. It was about tempering the degree of alcohol. And yet, I'm curious because you have people like Carrie Nation. In 1928, Wheeler demanded a radical increase in the Prohibition Bureau budget, even if it should require $100 million. You have, of course, the wiretapping of Olmsted's phone. I'm wondering if the extreme degree of many of these Prohibition activists had much to do with its swift repeal as far as amendments go.
Yeah, I think, well, it's the only one that's ever been repealed,
yeah.
So I guess we'd have to say
yeah,
swift.
Yeah, exactly.
I think that overreaction and overreaching had a lot to do with it, particularly after the 1928 election. I believe Smith loses very, very badly to Hoover, partly because he was a Catholic, but mostly because he was a Democrat, and the country was very, very rich and fat and happy, and it was a Republican decade, and no Democrat would have been able to beat any Republican, I don't think, that year. However, the Prohibitionists took it to mean an endorsement of the dry position. And so they then began to pass much more punitive laws than had existed before. There was one particularly called the Jones Law, which made it which mandated much stiffer prison sentences. Most liquor violations before 1928 were misdemeanors. This turned them into felonies, even the ones that had been misdemeanors. And so people were being sentenced for much longer terms than before. This was followed in Michigan, for instance. They passed a four strikes and you're out law, which said that on your fourth conviction for any violation of the liquor law, it was a life imprisonment. In 1929, a woman named Etta Mae Miller, who had 10 children, sold 2 pints of liquor to an undercover cop, and she got a life term. And this was horrifying to even people who were for prohibition. So the overreaching, the believing that they had a mandate because of the 28 election really was what I think one of the things that led to the collapse of the prohibition forces.
I'm also curious, because the political rhetoric at the time, like Griselda Hobson, who is one of my favorite figures in this book, speaking, take the offensive everywhere, attack, attack, attack. He sounds like Rod Steiger from Mars Attacks.
Richmond Hobson.
Sorry. And I'm curious if, he almost outdid Harding in his rhetoric. Mm-hmm. I'm wondering why that rhetoric was flowing at that particular time and whether the prohibition frenzy almost encouraged it.
Well, I think it did. And that time, we're speaking specifically of 1914, 1915. I mean, this is when the prohibition movement has changed from a state-by-state, let's pass a law here, pass a law there, pass a law here movement, to one that was trying to get a constitutional amendment. Until 1913, a constitutional amendment would have been unthinkable because the federal government was dependent upon the tax revenue, the excise tax from alcoholic beverages. In some years, as much as 40% of federal revenue came from liquor. You could not have prohibition unless you had a replacement for those dollars. So the constitutional amendment authorizing an income tax is enacted and ratified in 1913. Suddenly, there's another opportunity for the government to enrich itself, to fund its activities. And that's when the prohibitionists say, now let's go forward. We can get the constitutional amendment. So that spiked up the rhetoric as well. They saw that they were on a winning streak. They saw they were getting close to their goal. And then it was clinched by World War I when it became possible for them to demonize all the brewers as being, tools of the Kaiser, because the brewers all had German names. They were Schlitz and Pabst and Anheuser and Busch and so on. It's no surprise that what had been once a kind of almost a holy rhetoric of temperance, it became a strident rhetoric of prohibition.
Yeah. You write in the epilogue that in almost every respect imaginable, prohibition was a failure. Was it a success in any way, aside from the side effects that we've been talking about?
It's nice that men and women drink together in bars. I think that's a very good thing. I like the idea of the nightclub. People drank less as a result of prohibition, and I would say that that's a virtuous thing. People drank less, got into the habit of drinking less, and then also the new regime that came after prohibition of state-by-state liquor control laws enabled states to really make certain that it wasn't nearly as free as it had been before. During prohibition, anybody selling liquor, either retail or in a bar, had no license to lose. After repeal, you suddenly have a license that is your livelihood. And if you break the laws that didn't exist before on closing hours, age limits, where you can you be located near a school or church, Sunday sales, although that this new superstructure of laws really kind of regulated the liquor traffic in the way that it had not been before.
I wanted to also talk about the difference between the classes. The affluent were permitted to keep any liquor they purchased before 1920, thanks to a clause in the Volstead Act. Joe Kennedy had a formidable wine cellar in his basement. You also point out later in the book, when you're observing how the rich were flouting prohibition, that one of the distinctions between the working man and the rich when they were gathered in Wadsworth's mansion in 1927 involved this rich group knowing how to exploit working class anger. I'm curious as to, how calculating that was. We're talking about like a 7-year period there.
Well, I think that those who opposed prohibition, those who were in a position to do something about it, and you're speaking of the people who had gathered in the house of Senator James Wadsworth to see if they could bring about repeal, they were very knowing. They were extremely conscious of how they chose to pick your verb, lead or manipulate popular opinion among the working people to get rid of prohibition. You see in the letters of Pierre DuPont to his brothers about, Pierre DuPont financed, the DuPont brothers financed the repeal movement. And he says, if only we could bring back the tax on the working man and his beer, we can get rid of the income tax. You can say it was cynical, but it was certainly, whether you think it's cynical or not, it was very conscious.
One thing I didn't get from this book was a death tally in terms of alcohol poisoning versus criminal violence. Mm-hmm. Do you have like a rough tally of each? Which one caused more mortality?
No, I'm curious. I only have a sense. Yeah. Criminal violence, the thing that was somewhat mitigating about criminal violence, it was criminals against criminals. There were obviously the occasional innocent bystander who would be killed, but it was very, very rare. And if you count, for instance, the murder rate in Chicago, which was way up, it was, you know, it was one criminal shooting another criminal. The poison was indiscriminate, although it was obviously poorer people who were getting the less safe liquor. And certainly both numbered in the hundreds, maybe even in the thousands, but I don't think that anybody's been able to put a good figure on it.
Mm-hmm. Mabel Willebrandt, I was curious about one claim in the book where you say that Herbert Hoover fired her. Mm-hmm. But as I understand, she was looking around for employment around the time, and the new attorney general comes in and starts saying, hey, Mabel, guess what? I'm running the show here. Mm-hmm. And I'm curious why you say that Hoover fired her, what you relied upon to come up with that particular conclusion, because the resignation letter indicates that she went to be a Washington counsel for the aviation company. And I dug up some articles, and I was just trying to determine this because I got really curious about mm-hmm. this. Why did you conclude?
I believe it's in the notes. And as I recall, it's from papers that are in the Hoover Library in West Branch, Iowa, that he had come to the decision that he didn't want her to be doing this anymore. Now, it is under it still exists today under the conventional form of the way that people operate in the executive branch of the government. The president or the governor or whoever it might be says, I don't want you anymore, so you hand in your resignation. You formally hand in your resignation. But there's no evidence that she didn't want to do anything but keep that job until the new attorney general came in and did start to clip her wings.
Yeah. Well, I also know that she was waiting for the Prohibition Department to be transferred from the Treasury Department
to Justice.
Justice. Mm-hmm. And so I'm wondering, was there any indication that she just was getting sick of being the enforcer, or that she wanted lots of money?
If you read her memoirs and her letters, yeah, she's exhausted, but she was mostly exhausted because she had no faith in the Treasury Department. She really thought that, and appropriately, that the Secretary of the Treasury, Andrew Mellon, had no interest in enforcing the law. And so she was stuck trying to try the cases without the support of the person who was in charge of the agency that actually had the agents on the street.
In terms of what we can take away from Prohibition today, I mean, what would be the most applicable contemporary crackdown that you could see the closest parallel to today?
Well, that's kind of hard. I don't think there's anything quite like it, but I think the obvious comparison is marijuana. There are all sorts of lessons. I'm not making the case for legalizing marijuana. However, I think we can see in Prohibition and its aftermath some things that might lead us in that direction. For one thing, the notion that all this money in the marijuana produced by the marijuana industry is going into the hands of Mexican drug cartels without being taxed, without there any benefit to the federal or the state government, would suggest that maybe regulation would have a certain legalization regulation would have a virtue. Similarly, as I said, it became harder to get a drink after repeal than it had been during Prohibition. Most states do not have laws saying that you can't drive while stoned, for instance. Yeah. However, if marijuana were legalized, I guarantee there would be such laws. Most states, if you get stopped because your car's been weaving down the street, the cop will give you a breathalyzer test. That is not going to tell you whether there's THC in your system. It'll tell you whether there's alcohol in your system. If you legalize marijuana, I think that they would then have the devices in the cars that would do that. So, I mean, if you act as if it doesn't exist, which is what's going on with marijuana right now. The law doesn't really recognize that people are doing it. It says it's illegal, therefore it presumes that they're not doing it. Then you're going to have abuse. Whereas if you recognize its existence, you're in a position to regulate it.
Well, Daniel, thanks so much for taking the time out.
This has been a pleasure.
Great,
thanks. You very much. Great.
A story about a sinner. He used to be a winner who enjoyed a life of prominence and position. But the pressures at the office and his social ad engagements and his selfish wife's fanatical ambition, he turned him to the booze and he got mixed up with the flues.